This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Antoine Roy. Today is July 2nd, 2003, and it is 8:50 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Roy is in Jaffrey, New Hampshire. Sir, why don't we start with where we left off? I believe we're in January, February 1969, and you had just transferred to the 101st, and let's talk about what your actions and the patrols and what you did around the area of Fulak.
To go just briefly beyond that, I came back from my 1 month leave in the States, mm-hmm. and I joined the 101st. I was a couple of weeks AWOL because my stepfather's father had died. Mm-hmm. The Army had said no, I couldn't have an extra 2 weeks. I took them anyway. I figured, you know, hey, it's my third voluntary tour, and mm-hmm. what are they going to do to me? They might bust me one stripe. You know, I wasn't worried about it because I wasn't going to be a career soldier. So I got back. I got chewed on a little bit, but nothing more than that. Mm-hmm. They were happy to have me. I joined the 101st down at their base camp in Biennois, went through their jungle school, which was kind of excessive because I'd already served two tours in country, but that was the rules. Mm-hmm. I got through the jungle school and then was then sent north to where the 101st was operating up in I Corps. Mm-hmm. And out of their forward base at Fubai. Mm-hmm. At Fubai, I was assigned to a company, and it was D Company. I put in for 1st Battalion, 327th Parachute Infantry Regiment, so they had to give me that, but mm-hmm. they assigned me to D Company. I joined D Company down Highway 1, just a little bit south of Fulak, guarding a bridge at first and pulling patrols. Became part of a small special reconnaissance unit for a little while. Mm-hmm. Operating out towards the mountains. Again, the geography of Vietnam, from the coast, you'll have a lot of flatlands from 50 feet from the ocean shore to as much as 50 miles, mm-hmm. In the upper two corps especially. And in this area here, it was probably about 30 miles to the mountains. So in that all that flatland there, the whole company, in a cell, plus this little special reconnaissance unit we were part of. Mm-hmm. We're mainly conducting ambushes and patrolling to cut off infiltration into the lowlands and the villages and to try and intercept any communication or supplies coming from the villages out into the mountains.
Okay.
Spent about a month and a half at that bridge, and I believe the name of the village was Tui Fu.
Okay.
And then we transferred down to the north end of the Danang Pass to a village called Fulak. Mm-hmm. The battalion secured four main areas. Fulak, which my company was securing, just to the north, a village named Troy, where a large battle was fought at the end of the war by the South Vietnamese, mm-hmm. And the North Vietnamese. Down south of us near Fire Base Los Banos, and I don't remember the fourth village down. But there's a pinch point there. The Dunning Pass is very strategic. Anybody that, if the communists could have taken the Dunning Pass, which is about 20 miles long or so, they could have literally cut the country in half right mm-hmm. there.
Right.
All of the main convoys, of course, came through that pass as it was Highway 1. Any highways towards the interior of the country were cut and were too insecure, too difficult to hold, really. Mm-hmm. There's also a railroad line running up there, and at this time the South Vietnamese and the Americans were trying to get the railroad running again for the sake of commerce and trade and public morale.
Mm-hmm.
So the railway kind of went right alongside the road. When we got there, the railroad wasn't operating yet at that point north. So anyway, we arrived in Foolock. We split up into our three platoons and kind of spread across this very large valley that went way back towards the mountains. And then we'd pull ambushes every night and patrols during the day.
Mm-hmm.
So usually there would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, possibly 7 ambushes going out every night.
Okay.
The enemy was coming in every night and going out every night.
What do you mean by that, coming in every night?
They were coming in trying to maintain contact with their cells among the communist infrastructure in the villages.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of intelligence information to be gained as to what units were traveling back and forth, what kind of supplies. If a big unit was moving a lot of the equipment and rear echelon tents and cooks and stuff like that, would be traveling by truck.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if at all possible, they wanted to try and attack convoys. But at this point, they didn't dare. Our presence was really so great along Highway 1 at this point that any kind of attack could be almost suicidal because we could respond so quickly. There were artillery fire support bases all the way along Highway 1. And it was probably from the DMZ all the way down to Saigon within firing range of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And either American or South Vietnamese troops, ready reaction troops. The North Vietnamese did make attacks and the like. But they had to be very carefully planned, and they were relatively few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
It was mainly the smaller infrastructure and North Vietnamese Army connections that was trying to be maintained. The more they could build up the infrastructure in the village, of course, the greater their status was among the people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, a lot of this was done through terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time that I really operated close to the people, the civilians.
Mm-hmm. How did that affect the way that you actually operated personally yourself?
Well, I was fascinated. As a boy, I had lived overseas.
Mm-hmm.
As I said earlier, my father and stepfather were both in the military. So I'd lived in Turkey, I'd lived in Germany, I'd been to Mexico, I'd lived in Alaska, I'd been all over Europe and the like. So a foreign people wasn't that unusual to me, but this particular type of culture I hadn't run into before. But I could see that, you know, by that time, the people are people.
Mm-hmm.
The cultures may be a little bit different, the social mores and the like, but they're still people. And the South Vietnamese that I had met earlier, I had liked.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the civilians there. We had to be a lot more careful,
right,
to try and avoid civilian casualties. But past a certain point outside the village, no villagers were allowed to go out there during the day except to go for firewood.
Mm-hmm.
And they were usually watched. And I don't know, they may have had to have gotten a permit from the South Vietnamese authorities.
Who watched them?
South Vietnamese mainly.
Okay.
We noticed them, but it's not like we watched them real close, unless we saw something a little suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like going out there because, they knew that they might get caught in between.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that they might turn a corner and run into a patrol, and the point man on the patrol, of course, being very hyper alert, you know, before he's even able to notice it's a civilian, open fire.
Mm-hmm. What would constitute suspicious activity if the Americans observe them?
Well, obviously, if we saw them meeting somebody, if you see them go out and they spend a whole day out there and they come back with just a very little bit of wood, things like that.
Right.
Or if five went out and six came back, something, you know, again, or if five went out and four came back. But again, we didn't watch them that closely. That was mainly the South Vietnamese militia in town, the regional forces, popular forces, and the authorities that kept track on that. But, you know, we did notice them. And we were always a little suspicious. Maybe they were taking information out. But I do believe that probably the South Vietnamese authorities checked them before they went out. And they were probably registered and everything.
Okay.
There weren't that many. And past a certain point, at night, nobody was allowed. And this was right at the very edge of the village, allowed out inside the village. You went outside the village, you went at your risk. And you would have assumed to have been the enemy. Now, the people had lived with this kind of thing for years and years and years. So they were very used to it. But there were a lot of trails coming in through this flatland, covered with bushes and the like. There were two fire support bases on either side of the village. One was Fire Support Base Roy. The other was Fire Support Base Tomahawk. Roy was always occupied. Tomahawk was occupied on and off, sometimes with artillery, sometimes just a platoon of infantry. But it kind of jutted out, and Highway 1 had to kind of go. It was like a nose, a finger that came down, so Highway 1 had to swing over and around it. And if anybody had ever wanted to hit it with a, you know, hit a truck with a rocket propelled grenade or something, you know, one or two guys that snuck up would be a perfect place. It was also a good observation point. We arrived. The Marines had been there originally, years and years and for years, and they had had different Marine battalions operating down there. They had had Marine civilian action. Patrols, which are a squad of Marines that operates right in the village with the South Vietnamese militia. The Marines had were pulling out at the time or operating mainly further north, and the 1st Cav and the 101st had kind of taken over this part of their area of operations. Firebase Roy had been begun by Marines and Tomahawk, and you could see we could see in some of the hills surrounding us where there had been hill battles years earlier. Right dead center at the very end of the valley was a large mountain called Bac Ma. And Bac Ma was the first Vietnamese national park, but you couldn't go there because the North Vietnamese were there too. And the French had used it for a resort. When they were there, because being up in the mountains, they were able to get away from the heat and the mosquitoes. And from down in the valley, you look way up on top of this mountain, and you could see these old ruined buildings. And if you looked at the map, you could see that they extended. It was kind of like a housing development, but it was all luxury villas. At this time, they were all destroyed and run down and the like. There was a road going up there, but we never went up there. I always wanted to. We almost went up once when a Ford Observer aircraft was shot down, and we were ready to go waiting for the helicopters when all of a sudden we got the word that a long-range patrol unit had reached the aircraft and had rescued the pilot. So we didn't go. Mainly, we'd set up at a location during the day, get a little bit of sleep, and then go out on patrol, and during the patrol, we'd pick out a site for an ambush, which is always done very surreptitiously, because with the mountains surrounding this bowl going inward, a flatland, I mean, you were always observed. You knew you were being observed.
Were these platoon-sized patrols or squad-sized patrols?
Squad-sized, usually.
Okay.
And the platoon leader would be there, and he'd pick out two spots. At this time, at our strength, basically, we had two reinforced squads per platoon, whereas we were normally allowed three. But, you know, in military units in combat, it's extremely rare to be up to strength.
constitute a good ambush site? What would constitute a good ambush site down in this area?
Usually along one of the trails.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times we would ambush the same site because we could tell by how well the trail had been packed down and the like that it was being used a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Other times we'd ambush other smaller trails.
Mm-hmm.
There's the whole network of trails coming in. The place was like a spider web.
How well did you guys know all those trails? Or were you constantly finding new ones?
Very, very quickly we knew our terrain, the terrain that we operated in.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the whole valley was divided into three sections, one for 1st Platoon, one for 2nd Platoon, one for 3rd Platoon.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew, you know, the limits of our area so we wouldn't stray over into another platoon's area, maybe mm-hmm. run into them. We got to know the area very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd normally make a patrol during the day, and if the lieutenant saw a spot that he decided he wanted to pull an ambush in that night, I mean, no sign was given. We wouldn't stop. You wouldn't go back twice to look at it again. He and the platoon sergeant would just eye it really, really well, not say anything, not pull out a map, not do anything to give any indication that they were interested in that spot.
Mm-hmm.
And so the patrol had two purposes. One, to patrol and make sure nobody was sneaking in and hiding under the bushes, which they had to do because there's always helicopters flying overhead,
mm-hmm.
And to find an ambush position, let the enemy know we're there, let the people know that we're out there, and then we'd come back in, and then the platoon leader and platoon sergeant would get together, and the platoon leader would lead one ambush, and the platoon sergeant would lead the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then along about dark, we'd start out and go to our respective ambush sites. I was not very impressed at all with the North Vietnamese in that area.
Why not?
They were extremely inefficient. My experiences earlier with the North Vietnamese were far more dangerous than they were here.
Mm-hmm.
The North Vietnamese here, we did something that used to scare the heck out of me. And most of this battalion hadn't seen a lot of heavy action in a long time,
mm-hmm.
Since before I got there. And they would use the same trails. We'd come back and set up in the same spot for 2 weeks at a time during the day,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe change and go over to another area. And to me, you know, you're just asking to get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But the North Vietnamese very rarely did anything. And when they did, they inevitably screwed it up. I remember, in the times they did try and hit us, there was one time, there was a water hole where this big stream coming down out of the mountains took a curve and made kind of a big water hole before flowing on,
mm-hmm.
and made like a little beach. And every few days, when we come back from ambush, we'd go over to take a swim,
mm-hmm.
a bath. But what we would do is as we approached it, we tend to split up, you know, maybe four guys go over to on the same side of the stream, go to one side and the other guys to the other side, and then kind of watch as two or three guys cross the stream first,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to provide covering fire if it was an ambush. And then they'd check around. We'd leave an outpost over there.
Mm-hmm.
And then an outpost on the other side, and then everybody else would take a bath or swim. One morning, we're walking over there, and we just got to it, and the first man stepped out of the bushes towards the beach,
mm-hmm.
and normally he didn't. Normally we split just before we stepped out of the bushes, but they were kind of lax, and the first guy had just stepped out. The North Vietnamese were set up right across that little swimming pool,
mm-hmm.
and one North Vietnamese panicked and pulled the trigger when only one GI had stepped out of the bushes. And so what they had planned was, you know, these four or five guys to come out, start to cross a stream, kill them, and then take off.
Mm-hmm.
But one North Vietnamese cut an itchy trigger finger, panicked, and the shot went way high. And right away, you know, we deployed online, opened heavy fire, helicopters came in, and those North Vietnamese had to run for their lives. It was about a kilometer back towards the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was crawling through bushes and staying. We sent patrols. We landed patrols out behind between them and the mountains, but we didn't make contact. I believe there was one blood trail found. I would not want to have been that one North Vietnamese soldier.
Mm-hmm.
North Vietnamese discipline was extremely strict.
Right.
Another time, we were crossing that same swimming hole, going out onto an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine that I'm still in contact with, Johnny Hargett, was pulling point as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Both squads were in line, one behind the other, and we were going to separate at a certain point. And we got, one squad was completely across the stream. The trail went and continued on through the bushes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was about right in the middle of the stream. Well, Johnny up front was walking through a trail through the bushes, and then it kind of opens up because there would be these openings, like, to form these little glades. And as he comes out into the opening, he trips over something.
Mm-hmm.
But what he tripped over was a North Vietnamese soldier who was setting up a claymore mine.
Oh, my gosh.
The North Vietnamese had gotten into position late.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they thought they could have covered the distance from where they were coming, you know, a quicker time than they did. I don't know. But they got into position late. Or maybe we started a little bit earlier than normal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. He tripped over this guy, and at first he didn't know what it was he tripped over until he saw this shape in the dark, you know, go running off. He fired shots at it, didn't hit him. We had flares come immediately from Firebase Roy,
mm-hmm.
and then we could see them. Their whole ambush had broken up, and they were all running, and they were going through a lot of the open areas, and our machine gunner picked off two or three of them, and as their buddies come running up, they'd reach down. Each one would grab an arm and pull the guy off.
Mm-hmm.
We also had fire going out to left and right, depending upon, you know, thinking, you know, maybe they were forming a U-shaped ambush or whatever. But that was about the end of it until the next morning. And the next morning, we're searching the area, we're finding equipment, we're finding claymore mines, stuff like that, because they took off in such a hurry they had to leave everything except their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And battalion commander came in by helicopter, looked around, talked to us, and then he got in his helicopter and he started back off. Well, he got up in the air, did a turn, went over the river, and suddenly stopped and hovered for a minute and then radioed that there was a body floating in this big stream.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over there, and one of our guys, our grenadiers, had hit a North Vietnamese in the back with a round and killed him.
Hmm.
So they blew that one really, really bad.
Was this common, these mistakes? How often did these kind of mistakes
all
happen?
All the time. They tried several times to ambush us, and they just blew it, and the other platoons, too.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know. I really don't know. What I do know is that other areas where I had operated in, the way that we were operating, we'd have learned a bloody lesson real quick not to do it. Like
mm-hmm.
I said, we come back from an ambush and set up at the same spot for 2 weeks at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just asking for mines to be waiting for you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know.
Did you
I
talk
have no explanation.
Would you talk to the leader and say, you know, the lieutenant and say, look, you know, we should not be setting up in the same place day after day.
I'll go into that in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
One of the places we set up in was known as the old schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And what the communists used to do was at first intimidate the teachers, you'll not teach. Because, of course, they wanted to break down the educational system, get rid of all the intellectuals and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And if the teachers didn't take the hint, then they just plain kill the teachers or destroy the school, which is what had happened here. So the kids generally, sometimes if the parents had money, would send them privately to a tutor.
Mm-hmm.
So we used to set up in this ruined schoolhouse, and then there were some small temples on the outskirts that were abandoned and half ruined,
mm-hmm.
and you know, we'd set up in those. I'm trying to think. One night, and this is a fascinating story to me. One night we went out and we set up very close to one of the main trails coming out of the mountains. And we'd set up there before, and it was my squad. And there were two trails coming out of the village, and they converged into one trail that went kind of down into a gully, and then right up into the mountains. The mountains at that point were so close, were this large, dark mass right behind us.
Mm-hmm.
We had one position facing the village on the trail going in on one of the trails, and another position facing down the trail, the other trail heading to the village, and then the third position was facing on the trail coming in from the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And we had just gotten all set up in the light, and I was in the position facing towards the rear. The platoon sergeant, Sergeant Hawkins, and the squad leader, I don't remember his last name being with a K, they were discussing something at first. So automatically, I turned and watched the rear.
Mm-hmm.
And all discussions, of course, are in whispers. It comes natural. So they're discussing something. I'm watching the rear, and then I keep turning back and looking towards them. In the village of Phu Loc, which was in the background up against the coast, they had electric lighting, and usually the lighting was on until curfew time, which was probably about 10 o'clock. So I could see their outlines and from the lights in the village.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd just, you know, keep my eye to the rear towards the mountains. I was very concerned because at that time of night, what you would expect is the North Vietnamese coming in.
Mm-hmm.
They'd make their contact with somebody who would lead them into the village, and they'd collect the rice tax, any intelligence information, do their administrative and coordination thing, whatever, or punish somebody by murdering someone. The South Vietnamese militia, of course, had to live in the compound with their families.
Right.
And usually, you know, as it got late, maybe about 3-4 o'clock in the morning, you'd expect them to be coming back from the village, going back into the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little concerned because right now I'm the only one really watching the rear because the squad leader and the platoon sergeant who are in that position, they're discussing something. And like I said, I don't remember what it was. It was something they had to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just looking and looking. Occasionally I'll look back at them. Again, I can see their outlines against the lights of the village. And after about 5 minutes, I turn and I look back. And from the left, I saw a figure outlined against the lights walking right up to actually coming up that trail we had one position on.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a trip flare out in front of the position and a clip and a claymore mine. And the machine gunner was laying right on the trail, you know, pulling guard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently the machine gunner fell asleep. The North Vietnamese soldier, incredibly, while he was a Viet Cong in this case, as he was coming along, stepped right over the trip flare somehow without setting it off.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible to do. And I see him. He's walking right into the middle of our position. And he notices the outline of the platoon sergeant and platoon leader, and he can't hear what they're saying because of their whispering. Well, I can tell it's a Vietnamese. Number one, by the size. Number two, very thin. Number three, the floppy cap that he's wearing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind. I mean, that's you know, a Vietnamese. And it must be a communist Vietnamese. So I very quietly turned around, and I laid my rifle down right smack between the barrels, right smack between the faces of the platoon leader and the platoon sergeant, the platoon sergeant and mm-hmm. the squad leader.
Mm-hmm.
And why I did that was to notify them, and it was aimed at this Vietnamese, notify them quietly, hey, somebody just walked into the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And they turned, and they did what I intended. They looked down the barrel to see what I was aiming at, and they saw the person, and I'm just getting ready to pull the trigger, expecting them to pull their faces back a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I forget which one, either the platoon sergeant or the squad leader, took his hand and pushed the barrel of my weapon down to the ground and very angrily whispered, "That's On." Now, On was our Vietnamese interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
There was a problem with On. On used to be AWOL an awful lot. He had mm-hmm. a girlfriend up in Way.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, he was only there about half the time he was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
They pushed my rifle down. I said, "It's On." And right away, I felt like an idiot. Oh, God. I could have killed one of our own guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped, and I turned around, looking back, feeling 2 inches tall. And I looked back towards the mountains, and suddenly it just hits me like a lightning bolt. On was with the platoon leader squad that night.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy could not have been On.
Mm-hmm.
I turned around real quick. By this time, the guy had come in so that the platoon sergeant was between me and this Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, I realized right away what the situation was. This guy was part of the Viet Cong infrastructure in the village. He was coming out to meet a North Vietnamese group and lead them into the village
mm-hmm.
and lead them around to the different places so they could do the different things they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that told me, but he walked in, and then he stopped right in front of the three of us, and he whispered something in Vietnamese. Well, nobody moved, and nobody said anything.
Who's he talking to?
To these three dark shapes.
Okay.
And I couldn't get a shot because the platoon sergeant was between he and I.
Mm-hmm.
The platoon sergeant and the squad leader were in total shock, trying to figure out what was going on, and maybe still thought it was On for a second, and were trying to understand what he was trying to say. Well, the Vietnamese waited, you know, a few seconds, and then said something again in Vietnamese. And nobody said anything, and nobody moved. And I'm getting concerned because I'm realizing that, well, him just seeing us here, he expected to meet the North Vietnamese group somewhere in this area.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a group of North Vietnamese coming from behind us
mm-hmm.
someplace. And I'm getting a little nervous because I see this guy. I know what's going on. I can't tell what the other two guys are thinking. I know that there's somebody coming from behind.
Mm-hmm.
My mind is racing, but I can't get a shot in. So the guy, there's no answer, so the Vietnamese says something again with a little bit of impatience, like, "Come on, you guys, let's go. We got to get going." We didn't understand what he was saying,
mm-hmm.
but the tone of voice, you know, you can kind of pick up what somebody's saying,
mm-hmm.
especially if you've been around foreigners a
mm-hmm.
lot.
How far away were you from this group?
The squad leader was maybe 4 feet in front of me. And the Vietnamese was maybe 3 feet in front of him.
Okay.
And us three were kneeling down. He was standing up. That's why he couldn't see the size of our forms, or he'd have known right away.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have helmets on, but he'd have known. We were just dark shapes. And I could have stood up, but I figured Well, you know, the squad leader or the platoon sergeant's going to shoot him or whatever. You know, because I keep glancing back to the rear. I'm worried about these guys he's supposed to be. He's obviously supposed to be meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody said anything. Nobody moved. And the Vietnamese said something to the effect by the tone of voice, come on, we got to go. It's an emergency. And nobody said anything, and nobody moved. Well, now there's a little bit of anxiety in the voice of the Vietnamese. And when he whispered something again, it was kind of like, come on, you guys. Quit screwing around.
Mm-hmm.
We got to get going. But there's less confidence in the voice. And nobody said anything, and nobody moved.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started whispering. He whispered something again. It was like, hey, what's going on? And at the same time, I could see he took a step backwards.
Mm-hmm.
He really realized something's wrong here. All of a sudden, the platoon sergeant jumped up and grabbed. He had his AK strapped across their chest at diagonally, which is how they carried their AKs a lot. He grabs the AK. The Vietnamese, he wasn't strapped, I guess. He was just holding it at, like, port arms. And he grabs the AK. Vietnamese holds on to the AK, and they're tugging back and forth with the AK.
Mm-hmm.
I got my rifle up, but I can't get a shot. And they struggle, they struggle, they struggle, they struggle, and then the platoon sergeant lets go of the AK. The Vietnamese runs past him towards the mountains right across my front at a distance of maybe 7 or 8 feet. And I fired off 6 quick shots, and each shot lit him up.
Really?
And I missed.
Really?
I couldn't believe it. And I fired pow, 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 and then I stopped firing, and you could hear him going through these bushes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he would have gone through a cement wall trying to get out of there, but you could hear this going off into the distance, and this guy's creating a trail through this very thick brush.
Mm-hmm.
He must have been horribly scratched up and the like. Well, the first thing I did was look down at my M16 as if to say, what's the matter with this thing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was nothing wrong with the M16. It fired.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a possibility I hit him? Yes, there is a possibility I hit him. For one thing, he was definitely deaf in his right ear for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And he definitely had some powder burns. He was that close.
Okay.
And literally, he had stepped in between every shot that I had fired. So we radio in what had happened, and we get this command from company commander, stay where you are. Maybe you can ambush the group coming in. Well, that didn't make any damn sense at all.
Because they would have heard the shots and turned around.
They'd have heard the shots, right.
Right.
And they'd have known where we were by the flashes from the shot.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to convince them, no, we've got to move.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we got an order. You will stay there. So it was a very, very tense night. The platoon sergeant walked over to the machine gunner who got a very sick... Everybody from the other positions automatically jumped up, you know.
Right.
Come on, what's going on? What's going on? Because they hadn't heard anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because one man on each position was awake, and the other three were sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
So the platoon sergeant went over, kicked the hell out of the machine gunner for falling asleep on guard. A literal kick as he was laying there, and then and quietly chewed on him, and then. Do some discipline the next day, and then come back. So, especially the position that I was on, the platoon sergeant, platoon squad leader, and I, we were very tense because we figured that's the direction the North Vietnamese are going to come from.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, seeing where the shots were, the flashes, it could come from any direction trying to envelop us.
Right.
But it was a quiet night. For the whole night.
Hmm.
The next morning, as the sun was just barely starting to come up at twilight, I told the platoon sergeant and the platoon, the squad leader, I'm going to go take a walk ahead towards these mountains because I'm worried about this trail down in that gully, and I want to make sure nobody's there. And they said, that's stupid, you know. Number one, we're not going to send anybody with you.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't care. And then I was told, no, you're not going. And I just told the platoon sergeant, I'm going because I knew it was the thing to do. These people, again, had hardly seen any action. So I just went myself and kind of patrolled around, didn't see anything, no sign.
Why was it the thing to do?
Excuse me?
Why was it the thing to do for you to go out by yourself?
Because I was afraid that the North Vietnamese were slowly sneaking up on us during the night and were just waiting for daylight. And just as the sun dawns and just as the sun sets, mm-hmm. is a prime time for attack. You have time to get in there, do your attack, and get the hell out
mm-hmm.
before all of your support personnel, helicopters, artillery, everything piles on to help you
mm-hmm.
in both cases. And I wanted to make sure they weren't waiting for the sun to really get up where they could see close, you know, and then attack us.
And wasn't that really, really dangerous, you going up by yourself?
Well, I figured, you know, either way it was going to be dangerous.
Well, true.
I mean, so I decided, you know, number one, I had enough faith I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it had to be done, so I did this half circle around the area towards the mountains. That was my main concern.
Mm-hmm.
The area heading back towards the village, the brush thinned out a bit. And we weren't going to go back to the village. The other squad with the platoon leader was going to come up and join us. We were
mm-hmm.
told to stay there. But I wanted to check that area out next to the mountain. So I went out. I just took a little walk around and the like, very quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing there, so I felt better about it. And I got back in, and the platoon sergeant agreed to put a little outpost out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sun pretty well came up. We could see clearly. Well, I'm out there, and I'm actually two or three of us are looking for a blood trail. And nobody's looking for a blood trail closer than me
mm-hmm.
because I can't believe I didn't hit this guy.
Right.
So
now, were you taking some ribbing from the other guys when you told them how close you were and how that you had missed?
Well, everybody was a little bit, but it was more still everybody's astonishment
mm-hmm.
that, you know, the odds that we set up roughly where this guy was supposed to be, there was some annoyance towards the guy that had fallen asleep. And still, you know, just total surprise the North Vietnamese had been able to step right over the trip flare, walk right past this machine gunner,
mm-hmm.
and he probably thought it was a North Vietnamese machine gunner on guard, and since he saw some figures kneeling, he assumed that was the command group, so he just
right.
walked right to him.
Right.
But, and also what had happened was, all during the night, the platoon sergeant, you're laying on the ground, and if you ever sleep on the ground a lot, you've always got to kind of contort your body to go around roots and rocks and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you get used to it, and he'd had a heck of a time. Every time he moved around, it's hard for him, you know, something's sticking into him. It's hard for him to adjust.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the sun come up, he looked down, and there's the AK-47 that he and the Viet Cong were fighting over.
Hmm.
When he let go of it, apparently the Vietnamese also let go of it at the same time, but he didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And it fell to the ground, and he didn't hear it because the Viet Cong kind of started running then, and then I opened fire.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a weapon. Now, again, you know, we found the trail. I didn't find a blood trail at all. We could see the trail that he had made through the brushes. A helicopter came out, and it was the company commander
mm-hmm.
with a reporter from the Stars and Stripes. I don't like reporters. I don't care who they are.
Mm-hmm.
I do not like reporters. But he come out. Company commander had been on everybody, and this is something I had learned a long time earlier. American soldiers many times had the, you could fire semi-automatic or full automatic, a lot of soldiers tended to fire full automatic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you fire full automatic, your first three rounds might be where you're aiming, everything else is going to be, if you're right-handed, up and to the right.
Right.
If you're left-handed, up and to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a waste of ammunition. But I think it was kind of a fear factor. He just wanted to put out a lot of bullets. And now they've changed that. The M16s they have now, you have a semi-automatic, and you flip down to automatic, and it fires a three-round burst only.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to pull the trigger again to fire another three-round burst. And that is one of the best changes they've made for that weapon. Anyway, he had been constantly haranguing everybody for that.
Mm-hmm.
So he's out there checking around, looking at the weapon, you know, and he asked what happened, and I said, and he said, you fired semi-automatic, and he said, yeah, he said, good, good, because I've really been trying to encourage people to do that, and Roy, I'm going to send you out a case of beer, and I said, I don't drink beer, sir, and he said, I'm going to send you out a case of sodas then.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great, love it.
Right.
And then I talked to the reporter for a minute. And then they all got back in the helicopter and they took off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never saw the case of sodas. I never really expected to see the case of sodas.
You said that, do you think, for the benefit of the reporter?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. I think that was for my benefit and the other soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the point. The point is, at that range, had I fired full automatic,
mm-hmm.
That soldier would not have been able to step between those bullets. They'd have been so close together,
mm-hmm.
and I'd have gotten him.
Hmm.
And to jump ahead very quickly, when I left the unit,
mm-hmm.
The EPS, I went in, and they give you an Army Commendation Medal for being a good boy.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, oh, yeah, here's your Bronze Star. I said, Bronze Star? What's that for?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, that's for the time that you fired semi-automatic at that Viet Cong, because the CO was pressing everybody so much, you know, to fire semi-automatic.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts it into my hand, and I'm sitting there thinking, this is totally ridiculous. I'm getting a medal for firing semi-automatic and missing, when if I had fired full automatic, I'd have gotten the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a medal for actually doing the wrong thing in that particular situation.
Right.
Because that was the kind of situation automatic was meant for.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I left it with a Bronze Star. No V device.
Right.
Bronze Star for that. But,
that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a quick question. How would you and the others react to someone sleeping on guard duty?
It kind of depended. If it was somebody that did it repeatedly or somebody that got hurt, it could be very severe. When I was in the 173rd, we were humping that, you know, 70 to 100 pounds all day long, up and down hills. The sleep you got at night is you had 2 hours on and 4 hours off,
mm-hmm.
and then 2 hours on, 4 hours off. So you didn't get deep sleep, which comes about generally after 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
The work was incredible. I mean, I just can't describe, even because the amount of weight put on us was always to the maximum.
Mm-hmm.
And the work was incredible. Sometimes the stresses could be. And I'm telling you, fighting to stay awake is one of the hardest things that I've ever been through, and I've had to do it a lot,
mm-hmm.
During training and, pulling guard. And there are certain rules and regulations you have to observe. Number one, if you're sitting by your hole or your little bunker at night, you don't lay down to look at the stars, but keep your ears pierced, your ears open,
mm-hmm.
to listen. You don't do that because you're going to fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
When you wake up the next guy, the guy wakes up you. We do is we pass around one watch,
mm-hmm.
with a luminous dial. And that same watch is passed everybody all night long. When you wake the person up, you give him the watch, and you ask him if he's awake, he says, yeah. You don't turn around and go to sleep more, and you sit there for a second, make sure that he gets up, and you don't pull guard inside your hooch behind the position. You go to the position and pull guard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? When you see he's sitting there on the position, okay, then you go to sleep. The best thing to do is sit in a position, whereas if you fell asleep, you'd keel over to one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You never lean up against anything. Even then, you can fall asleep sitting up.
Right.
Being so tired, it happened to everybody now and then. Some guys, though, it was a little bit too often. I mean, it happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to admit it. And the way you find out is when everybody gets up in the morning and nobody's on guard,
mm-hmm.
the first question is, who's got the watch?
Right.
Because the person that had the watch is the one that fell asleep.
Right.
And, you know, and everybody's looking around, and it's a real sick feeling to look down and see the watch
mm-hmm.
laying there next to you,
mm-hmm.
you know, or on top of your leg or something.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen all the time. I do know of one instance when we won 73rd that a guy who was set up as a company, and he was a machine gunner, and he fell asleep. A few North Vietnamese got in close enough to throw a whole pile of grenades in and wounded 9 guys. But the gunner kind of redeemed himself because he woke up real quick. He was laying right behind his gun, and he opened fire and killed one, and there was a blood trail
mm-hmm.
for another.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some people I've read about, well, you know, well, the next morning they'll beat the hell out of the guy. Personally, I never saw that happen.
Mm-hmm.
What would generally happen is, you know, hey, you're falling asleep too quickly, and you do it again. And, you know, we're going to the platoon leader over it.
Right.
And then you can get real deep shit for
mm-hmm.
it. And heaven help you if anything bad happened because you fell asleep, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened. It just happened.
Yeah, I would imagine that.
Trying to stay awake, you know, when your eyes are, you know, it's just, it's a horrible, horrible fight.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just so tired. I would say it probably happened to me once a month
mm-hmm.
during the time with the 173rd. But it didn't happen to people all the time, but it did happen, and you know, sometimes a squad leader really give you a good talking to
mm-hmm.
and the like. But everybody accepted that it happened.
Okay.
Let's
take a break just for a moment.
Okay.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question. When you said you went out looking for a blood trail, what would you do with the blood trail if you did find it?
Would just tell me that the guy was wounded.
Okay. Okay. That's what I thought. You weren't going to follow it.
Personally, that would have made me feel better, and for intelligence reasons, you know that you've wounded an enemy soldier.
Right.
You know, you hear an awful lot about, oh, they concentrated on body counts too
mm-hmm.
much.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always stopped and thought, well, of course you concentrate on a body count. What? How else do you measure your effectiveness
mm-hmm.
in what you're doing? And the North Vietnamese, though they were willing to sacrifice a tremendous amount of lives, and they did, still they didn't have an infinite number of people. And you know that the more casualties you created in their units, the more it's going to affect their morale.
Mm-hmm.
But yet everybody seems to think that, you know, that this body count thing wasn't important. And it just didn't make any sense. And I've heard a lot of people complain about, oh, well, they take a hill and then they leave it the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And, what do you want? I mean, the hill's not important anymore if the enemy's not there. And since usually there's no trees left on top of the hill, the enemy can't use it again. And these confusions by people, you know,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is statements that are vogue. One person says it. It's like a demagogue. It sounds good,
mm-hmm.
but if you really think of the substance, no, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, do you think that the they overemphasized the body count. Yes, it was important to an extent, you know, obviously by what you said, but do you think that there was just an overemphasis on, okay, we can count the dead and wounded, and that's going to tell us the progress of the war?
Well, no, it also tells you, okay, let's say, I mean, you're fighting a regiment.
Mm-hmm.
It's a standard fact in warfare that if you inflict 30% casualties on a unit,
mm-hmm.
you have degraded the effectiveness of that unit by probably 80 to 90%.
Mm-hmm.
Because among those 30% are going to be key leaders, key people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next person in line will take over, but they've got to suddenly start doing a job they haven't been doing all the time. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You got a good machine gunner, you lose him, another guy takes over. Well, he wasn't firing him. He knows how to fire a machine gun,
mm-hmm.
but he wasn't doing it all the time. Same thing with a radio operator, company commanders, platoon leaders, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you lose those people, and it really degrades the unit. And this is just a standard fact all the way through the history of warfare.
Mm-hmm.
You talk to anybody. Second World War, First World War, you commit 30% casualties on a unit, and that unit is just not that effective any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you inflict 50%, it's virtually a worthless unit.
Mm-hmm.
They're easy pickings if you can get to them. Usually by that time they're pulling back and getting the hell out of there. But that's one reason too why you want to know. Now, sometimes did some commanders overcount?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I don't doubt it. That's a human nature, and some people are like that. This guy, Mel Morrell, used to go in after a huge battle someplace,
mm-hmm.
and both parties departed after the battle's over. This one unit Mel served in for a while, a multi-service unit,
mm-hmm.
they would go in and check all over and find the graves and find the bodies that weren't found, and do special intelligence for what kind of weapons were left and abandoned, how was the enemy set up, you know, analyze the whole battle,
mm-hmm.
and really give you a final idea of how well you did. You now know that, let's say, the 24th NVA Regiment is combat ineffective. You can get an idea from roughly the amount of casualties, and sometimes you can pick up a few prisoners of stragglers around and
mm-hmm.
get some more intelligence information. It's going to take that unit, you know, 6 months to get reinforcements, to get them retrained, rearmed, resupplied, before you have to worry about that unit again doing more than just maybe little hit-and-run stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it is important. Did some people overemphasize? Yes, but it wasn't that often.
I'm thinking like McNamara. I'm thinking up more at the top. They were really just, okay, how many dead today, this week, this month?
It's important.
Okay.
It's very, very important. I mean, during the Second World War, you were fighting a different kind of war.
Mm-hmm.
So then the body count was actually how many battalions mm-hmm. did we destroy? How many regiments? How many divisions? It's the same thing, except it's a macro kind of thing because it's a different kind of war. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got Army Corps fighting Army Corps.
Right.
And it's very, very important. And I just don't understand people when they get upset, oh, the emphasis on body count.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like in manufacturing. You know, how many widgets do we put out a day? If we don't put out, if we spend, you know, today we put out 5 widgets, and tomorrow we put out 20, well, what's the difference? What was the inefficiency? What do we got to reconcentrate on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we'd also sometimes dig up bodies and the like and find out what killed them. Small arms fire, artillery, airstrikes. That gives you an idea of what your most effective weapons are.
Right.
I mean, it really was important. But people talk about it as though it was immoral or unimportant, and usually it's people that just don't understand warfare.
I think the consensus has been I guess from the historian's point of view, looking at it, and some of the military figures who wrote about the war after the war, that there was an overemphasis on counting the number of dead. While that, yeah, it's important, there was just an overemphasis from the White House and in the Pentagon of that's how you can measure the progress of this war, whereas people have said, well, this is a guerrilla conflict, this is not conventional warfare, and maybe that's not the best way to measure progress in this type of conflict. But of course, this is all after the fact.
Well,
it's easy to make judgments after the fact.
Actually, that wasn't the only way they measured it.
Well, of course not.
They also
right.
measured it by the number of villages where the infrastructure had been destroyed mm-hmm. and the North Vietnamese pulled back.
Right, the
but,
pacification
I mean, you
program.
Have to consider many different things. There certainly was real concern about the number of American casualties, though.
Mm-hmm.
And the North Vietnamese were desperate to kill as many Americans as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much because they know they defeat us as much as the people at home, they knew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, didn't accept it.
You still think that's with us today? The American fear of casualties in battle? Or not fear, but just...
Westerners don't accept the fact that you're going to have to take casualties. Anything you do, I don't care if it's in warfare or whatever, there's a cost.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to be prepared to pay the cost. But some people just get so upset, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But again, to me, the cause has to be meaningful
mm-hmm.
and justified.
Mm-hmm.
I do not accept this Iraq thing.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam, I did. It's a completely different situation.
Mm-hmm.
The Korean War, the Second World War. When you get into this big fight to the death with somebody like the Second World War,
mm-hmm.
then people tend to accept their casualties a little more. But I do know that here in the States, my mother told me that, you know, a lot of people got upset at the number of folks that we were losing.
Mm-hmm.
And it did affect morale on the home front quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Soldiers will accept it more because they expect it.
Right.
But civilians just don't understand. And a lot of guys don't like talking to civilians about it because they've already got this thing embedded in their head.
Mm-hmm.
They're not open-minded to it, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Right.
And you get tired of just trying to, you know, explain the same logic over and over. You're talking apples and they're talking oranges.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Let me ask you, overall, you described how you guys would go out and find ambush sites, set ambushes, and then, of course, the NVA would also do the same.
Occasionally. Their main job was to get in, get the rice tax and the intelligence information, and to make sure that the infrastructure stayed strong.
Okay.
That was their main job. But once in a while, they got tired of being ambushed, and they try it themselves, but not that often.
How effective was the strategy of Americans doing ambushes in this region? Was this a good strategy, do you think, at this time, or should you guys have been doing something different to win the war?
Well, there's too much else we could do. I would like to have gone into the mountains
mm-hmm.
aiming for the source.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a lot of long-range patrols up in there. And if you ever take a look at the map out behind Phu Loc, you'll see it's an extremely, horribly difficult country. I've been in that kind of country before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to find these base camps. Number one, they spread them out and break them down and the like, and they'll tend to move them because they know that the long-range reconnaissance troops are out there, that aircraft doing infrared photographs, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And keep in mind that a lot of that sensory stuff then isn't as good as it is now.
Right.
We had just one-tenth of what we got now. The war would have been, you know, hands down.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you only have so many resources. So to conduct a major operation, you have to tone down in some areas. You have to prioritize what's more important. You can't have everybody conducting a major operation. You've only got so many helicopters. You've only got so much ammunition, so much fuel. And though we had a lot, we didn't have enough to keep all, 64 battalions plus South Vietnamese, in the field searching.
Mm-hmm.
And basically that's what we had to do most of the time was search. People don't understand, how can you not find them all in such a small country as Vietnam?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's small in proportion to the United States, but I'm going to tell you, I've been trooped all over that country and trying to look into every nook and cranny. It's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we would like to have gone more and more. If the reconnaissance troops found a major, major, major concentration of troops,
mm-hmm.
then an operation would probably have been forthcoming.
Mm-hmm.
If they find a base camp or something, generally they'll pull back, mark it real well, and then they'll call in heavy artillery or airstrikes on it,
mm-hmm.
which was far more effective than bringing in a battalion of troops.
Mm-hmm.
But what they would do then is probably bring in some of these special units just to see for a bomb damage assessment kind
mm-hmm.
of thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. Very demoralizing for the North Vietnamese because it would come out of nowhere. Sometimes precision bombing at night, B-52 strikes, heavy artillery in the middle of the night or even in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm.
But we did do other things. One mission we had one time, they had developed these sensors, and they developed them on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos,
mm-hmm.
and they worked relatively well. We had an idea here. They have these sensors, and you plant them in the ground, and there's only a very thin OD-colored antenna sticking up, real thin, almost looks like a blade of grass.
Mm-hmm.
And this sensor was a multi-sensor. It picked up ground movement within, I don't know, about 25 feet.
Mm-hmm.
It picked up magnetic, anything, metal going by. It could pick that up within about 25 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a regular acoustic as far as voices and the like. So all of a sudden, we got the word that the whole company is going to start over at one end of the valley,
mm-hmm.
and we're going into the mountains. And they didn't say why, and it made the whole thing look, especially to the Vietnamese, like, you know, we're going to go up and we're going to be looking at least for a kilometer into the mountains
mm-hmm.
for somebody's base camps.
Right.
No Vietnamese were allowed to come with us. So we went in, but we noticed that these guys came that we hadn't seen before, and we were told that they're engineers
mm-hmm.
in case we find things to blow them up. Well, we started off, and then we got out, and then they stopped us, and they told us what we're going to be doing. Well, these guys coming out are going to plant these sensors, and we're making this whole thing look like a regular search and destroy, you know, operation, search, basically,
mm-hmm.
Just a sweep of the area. So what we did was we'd go back in maybe half a kilometer or a kilometer, and right beside every trail, this kind of went up and down and up and down. You have these fingers and the like coming out, and then
mm-hmm.
trails down on the low ground between them or sometimes on top of the finger.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was we'd go along till we got to a trail in between. And then we'd stop and send out platoons like they were just cloverleafing and sweeping.
Mm-hmm.
And then these guys would plant these things off to the side of the trail. And then we'd go up to the finger. We'd move up to the top of the finger, and they'd plant one on the top of the finger off to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go down into the next trail, you know, so up and down, up and down. So we had everything covered. It took us about 5 or 6 days to sweep all the way around. Now, the whole thing centered back to Fire Support Base Roy,
mm-hmm.
Where they had the receivers from the sensors and the computers that would identify what was being sensed, which sensor was picking it up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And especially if all three sensors picked up ground movement, metal, and possibly the sound of brush moving or voices or whatever, or, you know, equipment clinking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a key sound. And then what they did is they figured out, on the average, at that speed that they went by, where would they be, let's say, 100 feet or 150 feet or 200 feet from there?
Mm-hmm.
And they knew how quickly they could get the guns up, get them loaded, get them aimed on the target,
mm-hmm.
fired, and have the rounds hit that spot.
Okay.
So they would aim that far after the sensor went off. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we got back in, and our firebase Roy was a huge firebase. Well, not huge, it was a big firebase. And they had 105 millimeter guns, they had 155 millimeter guns, and I believe either 8-inch or 175s.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes Tomahawk would have 155s, and certain parts were within range of a couple of other fire support bases.
Mm-hmm.
So we swept all the way around. We got back in, and usually we have these kids and the like, and some women that would come out selling us cold sodas, you know. And they'd ask us, oh, well, what you do up the mountain? Oh, we just swept around. Yeah, we killed a few NVA. We chased them all away.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, you know, orders were, don't you dare say anything to them because, you know, it's going to affect us.
Right.
Well, 2 days later, when the whole system got coordinated and tweaked, we were sitting there getting ready to go out on our ambushes.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, we heard from Firebase Roy, boom, 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 boom. And the rounds going out, you can hear them going through the air.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And we looked out, we could see them impacting on one of the main trails that we knew of coming out of the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's wondering, damn, I wonder if they picked up something. The next night, the same thing. The next night, the same thing. The next night, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kept on night after night in different areas and the like. And it just went on and on and on. And then finally it stopped. And there wasn't anything. And a long-range patrol captured a couple of North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
They'd set up an ambush on a trail, and they'd wait for, like, one NVA to come by. And they'd jump out and grab them.
Mm-hmm.
It's called a snatch.
Mm-hmm.
And they get them back into the rear and interrogate them. Well, they got one. And the North Vietnamese were totally perplexed. Their hospitals back in the mountains, way back in, were completely filled. They had convoys of wounded being taken back into Laos,
mm-hmm.
about 60 or 70 miles from there. And the North Vietnamese had no idea how we were able to determine. They sent out these huge patrols and sweeps because at first they were positive we had forward observers hidden in the trees or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they swept every single area and found nothing. So then they decided, well, let's try going along the side, halfway down the finger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing is, the sensor could pick up also down the finger. You know, you'd have two sensors actually to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that didn't work either. And that horribly cut back on their attempts at infiltration. And finally they got wind of what was going on, and they did find a few sensors.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, then long-range reconnaissance groups were sent out to replace any individual sensor. The batteries were only good for, I can't remember, 6 months or something?
Mm-hmm.
And then they had to be replaced, and usually they were moved to a new site. It cut back tremendously. So what the North Vietnamese end up doing is they'd go down a trail, then they'd do a zig up halfway up a finger, then a zag down the other. You know, they had to do all this extra walking,
mm-hmm.
because they knew if they kept on walking straight, they were going to walk right into artillery. Usually airburst right over them.
Mm-hmm.
So it made their job much more difficult, especially when you're carrying sacks of rice trying to get back into the mountain.
Right.
It also increased dramatically the security in just about all those villages along the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to be used over the rest of Vietnam also. It was really really some. It was the first time I'd seen that kind of high tech coming in.
What did that do for morale?
Oh, it was great. It lessened the chances of anybody coming along.
Mm-hmm.
You can be laying in ambush, but usually you literally lay right on a trail.
Mm-hmm.
One position looking up the trail, one position looking down the trail. And it's always kind of frightening, because even though you get claymore mines out and trip flares and
mm-hmm.
everything,
mm-hmm.
There's always a possibility they could step over them, or they just go off all at once, you know, and it's scary.
Right.
There's always the fear that somebody saw where you were setting up, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then close in on you from the side or set up an ambush for when you leave in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you always had those concerns. We also did a sweep in across Highway 1 off to the just barely to the southeast of Fulock in a triangular area of mountains. And what we were doing was cutting down all the trees on every single hilltop
mm-hmm.
so that we could land helicopters on every single hill. So, and I know North Vietnam Museum was found. We could land helicopters in different areas around them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that was started. Should have been done even earlier and much more. I'm sure ecologists would have been upset about it, but, hey, those things will grow back pretty quick. But,
mm-hmm.
And our first day, we split up into platoons, and we went across, split up into platoons, and every platoon would take a hilltop for that night
mm-hmm.
and clear it all big enough for at least one helicopter to land on. Our very first night, we were just across Highway 1 from Firebase Tomahawk. Firebase Tomahawk sat on the end of this finger that came down to a nose, like I said, overlooking Highway 1.
Mm-hmm.
When there was artillery there, they were usually self-propelled 155s, and they would set up this perimeter facing uphill, and it wasn't a very good it scared the hell out of me every time I was there. Again, it was obvious that these people hadn't had large North Vietnamese units in an area attack them very often,
mm-hmm.
and I always hated it. When there was no artillery there, on the other hand, then the outer perimeter wasn't manned, and the nose, right as it came down, went past the flat area where the artillery would set up. It kind of went up a little bit to form this nose that then dropped down steeply.
Mm-hmm.
And on the edge of this nose was a big sandbag fort, and it would fit a platoon real nicely. There was a big open flat area in front of it facing up the hill where the artillery normally would be. And then, all of a sudden, the position was great. It was very secure. Enemy would have to attack across a very open area covered by claymores and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very, very good little sandbag fort. Thick sandbags, pieces of steel, pierced steel planking they used for runways in between. It was great. But anyway, we were across Highway 1, and my platoon had that hill there, and I was facing guard towards the rear, and all of a sudden I heard all these explosions, and we looked over, and it was Fire Support Base Tomahawk being attacked by a battalion of North Vietnamese sappers.
Mm-hmm.
And they easily broke through the outer perimeter, which wasn't very heavily manned, and by guys that weren't paying attention. They were artillerymen. They didn't have an infantry platoon pulling guard,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they should have had. And artillerymen, you know, they just didn't. The bunkers were spread too far apart. They were very lax. They had never been hit before. And North Vietnamese broke through very easily, killed a whole bunch of artillerymen, destroyed all six guns.
Mm.
I mean, that was a major, major coup for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe they lost about 9. And they got away. The whole battalion was able to get back up the finger and back up where it led back up into the mountains. I remember watching it that night.
Hmm.
And then high command learned their lesson, they moved it over to another with a finger pulled off to the side and very heavily fortified it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is that position never should have been set up the way it was when it had artillery on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what lack of combat for a period of time can do to a unit.
Mm-hmm.
You can't stay at 100% alert unless you have a motive, unless you have the motivation to do so,
mm-hmm.
which means you have to be making relatively a lot of contact and experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you should have infantry manning a line, not artillerymen. They're not trained. They don't, they don't know how to set up bunkers and have cross-covering fire and things like that. But those things happen. It's, North Vietnamese units, we could tell we ran into a North Vietnamese unit now and then that had very little experience because some of the things that they did, they were just, I'm sure maybe that was probably a lot of the reasons that North Vietnamese screwed up a lot of their ambushes.
Mm-hmm.
Because they weren't used to offensive operations.
Right.
Their job was get into the villages and get out again.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that was it there. But really, during any war, the worst thing that can happen is to go a long, long time without making contact with the enemy.
How common was that to happen in the Vietnam War?
A lot of units didn't see the enemy for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone probably as long. One time, longest, even of all three tours. Oh, it couldn't have been more than 10 days.
Well,
so I was with at least make some kind of contact.
So you did not have that problem.
No, me. I was very upset with this unit. That I was in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to, kind of subtly, give these hints and the like. And, mm-hmm. and I get there and I'm armed to the teeth and everybody else is barely carrying the basic load.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking at me like I'm crazy. And, I'm looking at them like they're crazy.
Right.
Were
you still carrying the M16 or were you on the,
I carried a machine gun.
Uh-huh.
During when I was in that special reconnaissance unit,
mm-hmm.
and then otherwise I carried an M16.
Okay.
I carried grenade launcher only once during my first tour.
Okay.
They're fun to fire, but the single shot and boy the ammunition weighs a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta carry a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, trying to think, we didn't lose anybody killed while I was there for that unit.
Mm-hmm.
We lost maybe four or five guys very lightly wounded. The platoon leader was lightly wounded, though he was only gone for 4 or 5 days. The only guys I know of killed were on Firebase Tomahawk when it was attached. That was a Kentucky, I believe, National Guard artillery unit.
Mm.
Of course, a lot of people wanted the National Guard to avoid Vietnam, but then were surprised when that National Guard unit was federalized and sent
mm-hmm.
to Vietnam.
Right.
And there were a lot of units that were sent to Vietnam that were National Guard or reserves.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of helicopter shoot downs. I remember one time, and I read this instance in a book by a pilot who was in this group, who was set up, and I was facing looking out towards the ocean
mm-hmm.
at the time. And from the north, suddenly, around the edge of the mountains, a helicopter gunship came. And then right behind it, another one. And then right behind it, another one. And then right behind it, another one. And then right behind it, another one.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something like 20 of them, all in a straight line, which was rather unusual. Because I'm knowing something about helicopters, usually if they're transferring someplace, that means they'll be in a different kind of formation,
mm-hmm.
Usually staggered two rows. But these were all in a straight line. And they went across the sky, and they went across the sky, and as they got just about the center, by this time, I'm very noticed, and I'm pointing it out, and other guys are noticed. Yeah, that's kind of unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe they're all Cobras, gunships. And right about the center of Foo Lock, suddenly the front helicopter seemed to stop for a second. And then what I realized was he had turned.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's this whole line, as each helicopter hits a point, takes a right turn. So that they're straight overhead of us, mm-hmm. or that they're aiming, or like they're going to come straight overhead of us. And they're aimed slightly downward, at a slightly downward angle.
Mm-hmm.
And each helicopter reaches this point and makes this right turn until they're just about all on line, and they're right over our heads. Well, if you look down the line, they're all pointed towards this big mountain I was telling you about called Bak Ma.
Mm-hmm.
And right away now, something's up. What the hell's going on here? They're all pointing to it, and I'm realizing it looks like they're about to attack the place. And sure enough, they got to within range, and the first ship just opened up firing its rockets. And it'll probably carrying, minimum 14 rockets each.
Mm-hmm.
And they have had larger rocket pods on for this mission. But he fires rockets. And then you get within machine gun range, fires machine guns, and then turn off. And then the next ship, and then the next ship, and then the next ship, and the next ship, and the next ship, and the next ship.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something unusual. I hadn't seen 20 helicopters in a row attacking like that. And they were attacking targets in from the lip of the top of Bak Ma. Don't know what it was. Something must have been found there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all turned around, got back in line, and flew back north. Well, I'm reading a book later on by this gunship pilot, 101st. So he describes this whole mission from the point of view of the gunship pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting there thinking, I'll be damned, I saw that from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the date and everything matched. And it was like a gunship kind of raid. We also made what's known as an artillery raid.
Mm-hmm.
That's where our company assaulted further into the mountains, right at the base of Bak Ma, which had a massive cliff. This cliff must have been 1,000 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And we assaulted into what had been an old company position made couple of years ago, let's say. It was
mm-hmm.
still open. And you could land two helicopters at a time, big enough to bring in CH-47 medium lift helicopters that hauled 105-millimeter guns. So they assaulted us in there. We secured the LZ. They brought in a battery of artillery. Well, by bringing them, you know, a kilometer into the mountains and probably 5 kilometers from where they were to get to the mountains, you could then fire further into the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And intelligence had picked up all these areas where they wanted to shell. So they had it all planned. We assaulted in. The artillery was brought in very early in the morning. And they just fired artillery missions all day long, deeper into the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And then towards the end of the day, the CH-47s, Chinooks, they used to be called shit hooks by infantry. Because if you have a hooch set up, they come in there. They're tandem rotor helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
And the air wash was incredible. And a lot of times, everything we owned would get blown all over the place. So they brought in ammunition, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't want to be around them, but on a small fire base, you had no choice. But anyway, they came in. They hooked up the artillery. They took out the artillery cartridges, the brass
mm-hmm.
cartridges. They're worth money, and they're reused. And then they slowly started drawing out parts of the company. And got down to where there was just my platoon left, were the last ones out. And all of a sudden, on an operation like this, you'll have helicopter gunships flying around to cover you.
Mm-hmm.
And we're waiting for the choppers to come in to pick up the last two squad or our platoon. And all of a sudden, one of the gunships peels off and starts attacking a hillside off to our left. And we can't see what he's attacking, but he's attacking the heck out of it. And then
mm-hmm.
the second one attacks it, too. the helicopters are coming to pick us up, coming real fast. Get on board was the message we got over the radio right away. Get on board quick. We got on board, they flew us out, and come to find out one of the gunships had noticed a North Vietnamese mortar crew setting up their mortar.
Mm.
They were going to try to mortar the last couple of helicopters mm-hmm. coming in.
Mm-hmm.
But they were foiled because gunship pilot saw them setting up.
Right.
And they destroyed the mortar and the mortar crew.
Mm-hmm.
I also remember seeing, we were down at the schoolhouse one time, seeing on one of the foothills coming out a reconnaissance patrol, long-range LRPs,
mm-hmm.
used to call them, about six of them, standing on the open on top of his finger. And it looked like maybe they were coming out of the mountains, but I was kind of surprised they were standing on this finger right out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were within range of a long-range sniper rifle or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they were supposed to be picked up there or what. We noticed them, and, it's their business what's going on. Suddenly we heard explosions and looked up, and they were being mortared. Well, by standing out in the open like that, these six or seven guys, there happened to be, I guess, a North Vietnamese mortar crew nearby that saw them
mm-hmm.
and lined them up. I think they had one man slightly wounded. But again, they broke a key rule like that, especially for reconnaissance troops.
Right.
You never let anybody, you don't even want, the key is to get in, look around, and get out,
mm-hmm.
and have the enemy never even know you were there.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't want the enemy to know that somebody was snooping around and might have found something. Well, these guys broke that rule, and I was a little surprised at that.
Right.
At this time, they also introduced the new M33 hand grenade,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I believe, what they're using now. Instead of a oval, smooth-shaped grenade, this was a round, it was called a baseball grenade. It
mm-hmm.
was round, and it was just a little bit smaller, but it carried a more powerful explosive.
Mm-hmm.
And, tests had shown it was easy to throw it more accurately.
Right.
They also had them come out with an impact for an M33 grenade where you pull the pin and you let the spoon go and you can stand there and hold it all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't drop it. Because when you throw it, if it hits something, then it goes off. Now, that's an obvious advantage,
mm-hmm.
but it's a disadvantage, let's say, in thick jungle, because if it hits a branch, it'll go off.
Right.
Or if you drop it, it'll go off. But if you just throw it, and the enemy has no time at all to roll away or anything,
mm-hmm.
because some guys, I got to the point where, and I can swear it was 7 seconds. Other guys tell me it was five, and I just don't remember. But let's say 7 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I would take it, pull the pin, let the spoon go, and raising my hand lower. 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, and I want kind of 1,004 is when I throw it.
Mm-hmm.
It'd go through the air 1,005, it'd start to come down 1,006, and then when it hit the ground was time for it to go off.
Mm-hmm.
There were some guys who were willing to count to 1,005 to try and get an air burst over the enemy,
mm-hmm.
which is far more effective. But boy, once that spoon flies, you really want to get rid of that hand grenade.
I can imagine.
and most guys just threw them. The North Vietnamese, same thing. They would just throw theirs.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't depend. I don't know how many seconds their grenades had. I did know. I don't remember. But they couldn't depend on that amount of time being the same. They didn't have a sophisticated chemical timer.
Mm-hmm.
Because a chemical started to kind of burn like an acid until it reached the blasting cap, which set it off on ours. And theirs weren't, they didn't have the quality that ours had. They weren't as powerful. And used at least 25% minimum with duds.
Hmm.
So they had to throw theirs right away
because mm-hmm.
they couldn't depend upon them. And they were a stick grenade, you know, with a little like the German grenades.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Once in a while, they had Russian and Chinese grenades or American grenades, but I always thought they were very inaccurate to throw. I remember trying throwing them. But this new baseball grenade kind of impressed us. We liked it an awful lot.
Mm-hmm. Take advantage of the American boys' familiarization with throwing baseballs.
Probably, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm trying to think.
Our time's almost up. Do you want to stop for today?
Yeah, and then we can just wrap up, the final endings of that tour the next time.
Okay. We'll go ahead and end for the day then. Thanks.
Okay.
This is Dr. Richard Verone, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Antoine Roy. Today is July 31st, 2003. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room. It's approximately 8 minutes before 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. And Mr. Roy, you're in Jaffrey, New Hampshire. Let's continue. We're into your third tour, nearly wrapping up your third tour, and I wanted to ask you about your interactions with the local Vietnamese, and specifically the indigenous South Vietnamese military forces. What can you tell us about that? And this is in the spring of 1969.
Right. Mm-hmm. Spring going into summer of 69, early summer. Generally, this was the first time that I had operated extensively around the population. Most of my other tours were usually out in the mountains, but at this time here, we were taking over security around the villages in order to keep the North Vietnamese from coming in, setting up more of an infrastructure than they already had, gathering intelligence information,
mm-hmm.
Collecting supplies that they needed to live on, especially the rice tax that they imposed. The villages in South Vietnam are in a very difficult position, as civilians in a lot of war areas are. In a guerrilla kind of war, where you have both parties around, if you do something to favor one party, you risk retaliation by the other.
Mm-hmm.
And you try to maintain that very delicate middle line. And a lot of times you have to kind of give in to both sides, but do it in a way where you don't overly alienate the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So most Vietnamese, you know, during this time that I really, really, you know, got to know the village life of Vietnamese, they were a little standoffish,
mm-hmm.
and I feel it was for a couple of reasons. Number one, again, they didn't want to get too close because they were afraid of retaliation
mm-hmm.
By the communists. Secondly, we were foreigners. Our customs were quite different. We were a larger people. And, of course, here's a bunch of teenagers, especially walking around armed to the teeth.
Right.
And South Vietnamese know teenagers just as well as we do.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the same problems, of course. And teenagers don't think a lot of times. They tend to react.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a little caution there. Now, there wasn't outright fear shown,
mm-hmm.
but a little bit of standoffishness. If you approach them and try to talk, you know, very friendly, they'd be friendly in return usually. You had to be careful with the girls, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It might be taken as a sexual advance.
Mm-hmm.
With the old people, it was best to show an awful lot of respect, though not all Americans understood that, because in our society the elders do not have the position of respect that they used to have
mm-hmm.
in our society. Whereas in third world societies, it's the elderly that carry all the knowledge forward.
Right.
And the people depend tremendously upon that experience. Also, the family unit in third world countries is the all extended family, cousins, aunts, uncles. You know, if you were to offend one Vietnamese, you could end up offending an awful lot. Because
right.
if you offend somebody in the family unit, and that family unit being all important, I mean, that resentment spreads to the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
I believe a certain amount of problems were expected by the Vietnamese because, again, they understood soldiers. They understood immaturity in teenagers. I mean, they encountered it from the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong also.
Mm-hmm.
They did know that our standard operating procedure was not one of terror, generally, and that usually if there was an incident, they knew that it was not our overall standard operating procedure.
Okay.
But again, individuals will deviate. Well, not just teenagers, I guess. Even older people, you see it, you know. Deviate from the rules,
mm-hmm.
Lose control of themselves. Some personalities are more aggressive than others.
Mm-hmm. Or do any incidents come to mind when you're talking about that sort of thing?
I remember we had an Indian in our unit. There were a lot of American Indians I ran into. And Indians, of course, physiologically have a problem with the absorption of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, during the war, each GI was allowed 2 beers and 2 sodas a day.
Mm-hmm.
When I was way out in the field, we never got that. During this last tour, where we were close to the supply areas, Fulak is right along Highway 1,
mm-hmm.
The large supply bases and base camps at Fulak, I mean at Phu Bai, Hue, Camp Evans, and Da Nang and the like were relatively nearby. So, you know, they did get it to us. And somebody like me who didn't drink beer, I would trade off my 2 beers for 2 sodas.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. This one individual had a few beers, and he was normally kind of aggressive anyway. He was in the Army for, he stabbed somebody in a barroom brawl,
mm-hmm.
and back then, during the war, since they always needed soldiers, a lot of judges would give the option, something like 5 years in jail or 3 years in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And the average person, of course, would realize you're better off taking the time in the Army,
mm-hmm.
than in prison. But I remember there were two prostitutes and their pimp. And prostitutes would come out to our positions just outside the village occasionally. It wasn't real common, but maybe once every week or 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it was me and 3 or 4 other GIs. We were a short ways from where the platoon was set up, and the pimp was trying to promote some business.
Mm-hmm.
And the Indian that we had, he was like I said, he'd had some alcohol and he was feeling a little more aggressive than usual, and he literally kind of started a fight with the pimp. The rest of us standing around found it rather distasteful.
Mm-hmm.
But we also knew that if you're going to disagree with this guy when he's drunk, you're going to get yourself into a big fight.
Mm-hmm.
And especially since we're all carrying weapons, anybody with alcohol is a real danger.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a quick question before we continue. What would the pimp say to you all? You know, how would he advertise? How would he try to entice you all?
Using pidgin English, I mean, it was quite straightforward. I mean, it was not hard to recognize a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, the women did not hang around GIs. There was a merchant kind of class that did, but they made it very obvious very quickly. They're there just to sell sodas or trinkets or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can tell what somebody's selling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you said sometimes they would actually come out to your positions?
Outside the village. A lot of times they weren't from the village. Mm-hmm. They may come from one of the cities nearby, like Wei, mm-hmm. Fubai, or Dunning. But generally in this village, there were no village prostitutes or anything that I was aware of. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong. I don't know. Anyway, Chief just kind of pushed this guy and pushed this guy around and then punched him real hard in the stomach for no good reason, a real bullying kind of thing. But it was the alcohol speaking. Mm-hmm. And the two girls were very upset and helped him away. And I think we let I'm trying not to name names, of course.
Right.
We let him know that, you know, what'd you do that for? There was no reason for that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he got a little defensive and then tried to blow it off and then went back to the platoon area. I remember feeling, you know, very, very negative about it. You know, that was stupid. By that time, I'd been there, you know, my third tour.
Mm-hmm.
Not only I personally disliked that kind of behavior in people, you know, I realized that didn't help our cause at all.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The next time they came around any American unit, they may be gathering intelligence information also to hand over to the communists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those kind of things happen, but not very often, very rare. I remember something very immature that I did and regretted immediately and have regretted, you know, pretty much mm-hmm. ever since then. We used to have these children come out along with a few older women, and they would sell cold sodas.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't allowed to sell cold beers, if I remember correctly. But cold sodas they were able to, and they had obtained ice, whereas the sodas we got from the military were warm.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd have this bag filled with ice, and they'd have sodas in it, and they charged 50 cents a piece for them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's where graft and corruption comes in, because these were American, you know, Coke, Pepsi, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't get them legally. They were bought from Americans who were stealing from a tremendous amount of supplies. I mean, those millions of pallets of sodas and the like coming into country.
Mm-hmm.
And some enterprising GI would sell off a pallet here or there. And that's what he's getting, and these people would buy it from whoever got it from the GIs. We weren't overly upset about that since they offered him cold. But there was this one little girl, and she was cute as a butt.
Mm-hmm.
She must have been 7 or 8. Very, very nice little girl. Oh, and I was really close friends with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, one day I was feeling a little, I don't know how to put it, ornery, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to wear this beautiful wide-brimmed hat with a very colorful bow around it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a hat that I wore, a floppy hat. We didn't wear our helmets very often this time. And I took an attraction to the ribbon she had around her hat.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I kind of pushed and pushed. I asked her for it, and then I just took it. And she got real angry at me, justifiably so.
Mm-hmm.
And she wouldn't talk to me again after that. I tried to somehow make it up to her, offer it back, but, I mean, she just didn't forgive me.
How had you had become good friends with her?
I don't know. There were always kids around. They had to stay at a certain distance from the center of our perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt in my mind that some of them were counting.
Right.
And what kind of weapons and the like.
Right.
But I think most of them were just making some extra money.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you know, if I had some C rations I didn't like or whatever, you know, to offer to the kids. Usually to this girl and this one other little boy that he got close to.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know why I did what I did.
She never forgave you?
She never forgave me.
How much more did you see her after that incident?
Oh, another month or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt bad about that, and I, you know, to this day I feel bad. I felt, number one, I felt that I should have somehow, you know, when I got my pay, whatever, gone, try and find out where she lived and gone to her parents and apologized and, you know, paid some sort of remuneration.
You think that now or you felt that then?
I think that now, I guess.
Do you remember her name?
I don't remember thinking it then.
Do you remember her name?
Oh, Jesus, no, I don't. I used to.
Mm-hmm.
The little boy was nicknamed Water Buffalo, and I won't go into why.
Okay.
But, you know.
All right.
But this little girl was, oh, Jesus, shit, nice. I really, you know. And those little actions, of course, didn't endear them to us.
Mm-hmm.
She went on selling sodas and talking and playing with some of the other GIs. GIs used to play with kids all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got along great with kids.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them you had to watch. They might try and steal something.
Mm-hmm.
They would never try and steal a weapon or ammunition or anything because they knew if they got caught doing that,
right,
they're in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Their whole family's in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but the vast majority didn't.
What percentage would you say of the children were actually you had to watch that were out there to steal something?
Oh, very, extremely low.
Okay.
My impression is that probably roughly 10% were sent out by their families that supported the communist cause. Again, just to count how many men are there every day, if new men are coming in, if new weapons are trying to determine, you know, whatever might be of military value.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they learned a lot, except how many men we had at any time, which can be a little valuable. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, we never, ever discussed where we were going or anything like that with the kids. But, that's one of those things that, you know, I really felt lousy about and feel lousy about now.
What did you do with the ribbon?
I put it on my hat.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I even have a photograph of myself, black and white.
Mm-hmm.
But I never really felt comfortable about it. But, you know, that's one of those things, too, when you're a teenager, you look back later and you wonder, what was I thinking,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
There were, like I said, a few adult women selling sodas and the like mainly, or some trinkets, or
mm-hmm.
some Vietnamese pastries.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, we got along with them pretty well. Like I said, there was a certain line. They weren't allowed to come any closer than, you know, a certain line.
Mm-hmm.
We carried on talking and joking and kidding. And, you know, it wasn't a bad relationship at all, generally. And like I said, GIs, you know, and I've read during Korea and during the Second World War, it's the same thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. And there were other kids I got along with, too. But this one incident, I really felt hurt by my behavior.
Mm-hmm. How many months was this before you left?
About a month or so,
okay.
Maybe a month and a half, possibly. I don't know. I don't remember exactly, but towards the end.
Did you know when you were going home exactly?
Oh, yeah. I knew that my ETS, or my end of time in the service there, was July the 18th.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I told you I'd been AWOL when I went back for my third tour.
Yes, sir.
With every intention of going back, but my stepfather's father had died, and, you know, so I just took an extra couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew when my ETS, or also known as DROS,
mm-hmm.
When you just plain leave country date was.
Mm-hmm.
My my last mission, or the last few missions I remember, as I had said, generally every night, each platoon of the three platoons sent out two ambushes
mm-hmm.
in this big kind of rice bowl that went in from the sea
mm-hmm.
To the mountains. And my last, my actual last mission I remember was an ambush at an area where a site where we had ambushed several times before. We never did it, you know, twice in every night. It was always random.
Right.
And I remember thinking, you know, this is it. This is my last combat mission of the war.
Mm-hmm.
I was wrong, but it was my last ambush, actually.
Did you take any extra precautions or different precautions?
No, just the same old thing.
Okay.
And we had our rucksacks and the like, and generally on an ambush, or most of the times, you know, well, the most common type of ambush we did here was be on a trail, set up a position looking down the trail
mm-hmm.
one way and a position looking up the trail the other way, set out trip flares, claim more mines. And then one man at a time would be on guard on each of the two positions
mm-hmm.
While the other men would sleep. And then, you know, you'd wake up and pass off guard. It was near a stream. But I remember thinking consciously all night long, you know, well, it's over now after all this time and the like. And,
mm-hmm.
God, I don't know how many ambushes I've been on during my two infantry tours, just so many of them.
Did you have any thoughts about continuing?
Yes, I had some earlier. We were up at a place called Fire Base Tomahawk earlier. There was no artillery at the base. We just occupied this little sandbag fort on the nose
mm-hmm.
of the finger where the fire base had been located. This was before it was attacked and overrun, and they moved it to a more defensible area.
Mm-hmm.
But I was alone, sitting out on the hillside next to it and looking out over the South China Sea and contemplating taking what was known as a short,
mm-hmm.
which was re-enlisting for two more years.
Mm-hmm.
And you could pretty well specify what you wanted, and I was thinking of specifying, well, you got to give me Vietnam for the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about to do garrison duty. And I was thinking about my next tour going LURPS, or long-range reconnaissance patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, gee, I wonder how an advisor would be, you know, to get even closer to the Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought very, very, very seriously about it. But then at the same time, I mean, the hippie culture in the States was really going ahead, and it sounded kind of interesting, short skirts, everything sounded very liberal back, which it was, of course,
mm-hmm.
in 69. I thought about it, and I also realized that one of several reasons that I kept extending was that I knew that I had this fear, and for some reason I felt that, you know, maybe I should be like somebody in the movies
mm-hmm.
to go into combat and not hit, and to be fearless, and which, of course, is irrational. And I think at that point I realized, looking back over it, that fear in all organisms is a survival reaction. Any organism that has no fear isn't going to survive
mm-hmm.
as a single organism or as a group,
mm-hmm.
a species. And that fear has its purposes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And other people would express it and not feel uncomfortable about it,
mm-hmm.
whereas I would, and I realized that, you know, well, I really have given more than what was originally asked. I volunteered for all three tours and for the service, and all three tours in combat. I didn't win a whole bunch of medals or anything, but, you know, I'd been wounded twice. I'd volunteered voluntarily put my life on the line the three times.
Right.
You know, like I said, I realized that you don't just get jaded to fear. If you do, your chances of survival drop dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized that, well, you know, there's no reason to pursue this irrational feeling any longer. Again, looking at all the liberal things going on in the States, I thought, you know, in Vietnam, things had changed so much for the positive, and I was really seeing it. And they had announced that one brigade of the 9th Infantry Division and eventually the whole division was going to go home.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing things now through reading and talking to certain people down in the Mekong Delta area,
mm-hmm.
actually security was improving dramatically. South Vietnamese Army was getting better, and actually got much better, even their militia. But of course, as I've said before, what finished them in the end was the United States, not the fact that they didn't try fighting in
mm-hmm.
the end. But anyway, I figured, you know, my feeling was the war was going to come out positively.
Is that what kind of positive changes did you see?
Oh, there were areas in Vietnam when I got there that were quote unquote owned by the communists.
Mm-hmm.
The VC had a very strong combat. Had strong combat formations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after Tet, the VC combat formations were all destroyed, and the North Vietnamese had to fill out
mm-hmm.
VC units. They kept the term VC regiment or VC division, but actually they were North Vietnamese. They kept the term for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, in let's say June '69, there was no area that American and Allied forces did not fear going.
Okay.
We knew we might get into a big fight, but we knew we were going to win it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nowhere that was considered owned by the communists.
Mm-hmm.
There was only generally one area that we did not go into, and that was basically because it was so far out in the middle of nowhere. We still should have gone out there.
Where was it?
Oh, it was about a 60-mile stretch along the Laotian border,
mm-hmm.
From along Highway 14, going from Doc Peck,
mm-hmm.
which was a special forces camp, and then the highway continued up, and you didn't get to the next Allied base until you got to It had to be abandoned during the siege of Khe Sanh because they couldn't handle two big areas at once.
Mm-hmm.
Khem Duc.
Okay.
Khem Duc. And it was a 60-mile gap there in which the terrain was incredibly rough.
Mm-hmm.
You would not be able to supply by road. The roads were literally cut into the sides of mountains. It would take you thousands of troops just to secure the roads.
Mm-hmm.
When the monsoon season hit in that area for its 3 months, it would shut down any roads and the like. It was a real wild area. But the North Vietnamese were able to use that gap, that 60-mile gap between Doc Peck and Khem Duc,
mm-hmm.
to infiltrate a lot of troops and supplies into areas like the An Lao Valley, where they provide a lot of resistance, into the Hiep Duc Valley,
mm-hmm.
Into the Khe Sanh Valley, and it never was closed.
Okay.
And it should have been. But anyway, you know, generally the whole situation had changed. The Vietnamese were now better armed. They were getting better and better all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I felt that the war would come to a successful conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided, you know, no, to heck with this. I'm going home.
Right. You've done your part.
Right.
So you said that last ambush turned out to not be your last mission.
No, after we came back from the ambush, they were getting ready to take us up to Fire Support Base Roy, mm-hmm. and from there, which was just barely to the north of Fulak, and from there, they were taking us back to Fubai, mm-hmm. the base camp, mm-hmm. for a four-day stand-down, which means, you know, you're in the base camp, you don't pull guard, you just party all the time, they had steaks, and, mm-hmm. you know. These things, they happen about once every 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
A real relaxing kind of thing. In a base camp. Or an extremely large forward base camp, one of the two. But, about once every 6 months,
mm-hmm.
this would happen.
Okay.
So, we're getting ready to go, and all of a sudden we get the word that some two naval coastal patrol boats,
mm-hmm.
They're about, I don't know, 20, 25 feet long, had two 50 caliber machine guns in armored tubs in the front and two mm-hmm. in the back, that they had encountered some firing the night before along one area of this bay that Fulak was on. Mm-hmm. It's called Kauhai Bay. And they wanted to know if an infantry platoon could be inserted to see, you know, what the results of the fight were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these were naval personnel in boats. They didn't do infantry kind of thing. So my platoon was volunteered by the company. So while the rest of the company got in the trucks to go up to Firebase Roy to then transfer to Fubai,
mm-hmm.
Helicopters picked up my platoon and flew us over to this shore area where offshore these two patrol boats were still sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, damn, you know, I thought that was my last mission.
Right.
And at that time, I didn't like flying. I developed a fear of heights and flying
mm-hmm.
as a door gunner. But, you know, had to go, so I went.
Mm-hmm.
We landed right on the beach. There was nothing. We searched all along that shoreline with the two naval patrol boats offshore.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't find anything. We didn't find any tracks. We didn't find any expended cartridges. We didn't find anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was no indication that they'd been firing. You know, I don't know what had happened. They just said they took some fire.
Right.
Anyway, so we searched that area, and the helicopters were supposed to come back in and pick us up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, while we're waiting for the helicopters, we kind of took it easy on this little rocky promontory. We didn't worry about security because the Navy kept two patrol boats there,
mm-hmm.
And they were only about 30 feet offshore. And with basically 850 caliber machine guns plus our own fire, you know, we knew that, you know, if anything happened, we had plenty of fire support. And,
mm-hmm.
and right across the bay was Fire Support Base Roy,
mm-hmm.
Which stood out on a peninsula into the bay. And so we waited for about an hour, hour and a half, or 2 hours even. And then the word came down that they couldn't get any helicopters in. They had been prioritized to someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we didn't have our rucksacks or anything, just our fighting gear. So they asked the Navy if the two patrol boats would ferry us across Kauhai Bay over to Fire Support Base Roy.
Mm-hmm.
And the Navy said, yeah, sure, why not? So they put a squad on each one of the boats. And that turned out to be very exciting. These boats travel real fast,
mm-hmm.
and we had a good time going across the bay.
Mm-hmm.
I realized the bay was a lot larger than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, looking across it, but then going across it by boat, and these boats travel very fast. It took a while to get there. So actually, that was my last mission of the war. And they dropped us off at Fire Support Base Roy. We rejoined the company. They put us in trucks and took us up to Fubai.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, another battalion came in. I believe it was 2nd Battalion, 327th Infantry, one of their, and then they took over the four villages along the coast that the 1st Battalion had been covering, and one of their companies took over Phu Lock from my company, D Company, 1st Battalion, 327.
Okay. And then how much longer before you actually departed country?
We got up to Phu Bai. It was supposed to be a four-day stand-down. And we got up there, and right away they had steaks on the grills and plenty of beer and sodas for everyone and all kinds of good stuff. And they'd scheduled movies every night for the next three nights, I guess it was. And we'd been there about roughly 5-6 hours. We got there about noontime. Maybe about 6 o'clock or so. It's just starting to get a little bit dark. Everybody's getting ready to see the movie, and 75% of the guys are drunk. And I'm knowing that, you know, this is like the 15th or the 14th of July. I'm due to ETS on the 18th. And I know that basically, you know, I'm going to this big party, and then I'm going home.
Right.
And I didn't mind. I figured, oh, that's a really great way to leave, you know, Vietnam. And so as it came time for the movie to everybody was gathered around in front of the movie, the screen they'd set up. And suddenly the first sergeant, and this man deserves a medal for what he did, the first sergeant walked up onto the stage, took the microphone, stood there for a second looking over the crowd, and all of us, you know, looking at him, expecting him to announce what the movie's going to be and what other things are going to happen, and he says, men, and I don't remember the exact words, but to the effect that things happen in wars where we have to be able to adjust. His name was Sergeant Dako, First Sergeant Dako, and he passed away last fall. I remember hearing that from the group on the Internet.
How do you spell his last name, do you know?
Excuse me?
How do you spell his last name?
I believe it was D-A-Y-C-O,
Dako. Okay, all right.
His first sergeant of the company. And he said there's been some very heavy action out in the Ashau Valley, and the four-day stand-down has been cut. As of tomorrow morning, you'll be flying straight out to the Ashau Valley. And the beer cans, the soda cans, the food and the like that went flying towards this poor man standing on the stage was incredible. He's ducking and dodging, but at the same time, he's still sort of standing at attention, you know, maintaining his dignity. He knew damn well what was going to happen. And everybody is cursing and screaming and grousing and rah, 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 rah.
How did you feel?
Well, it didn't make any difference to me personally, but my feeling was I was frightened for them because while I had been with them, they had mainly been around Phu Lock and one other bridge, Tui Phu, and we'd gone up into the mountains a couple of times, but not very deep into it. And there hadn't been any of the big, big toe-to-toe, duke-it-out, bloody meat grinder kind of battles, you know. But in the Ashau, which was right along, which bordered on Vietnam, you could find, you could still find large NVA units who came loaded for bear and ready to fight. And I was kind of concerned because these guys hadn't seen that kind of action before. I had talked to the platoon leader a couple of days earlier about, you know, sir, you've never seen the kind of action that sooner or later we're going to be seeing. And, you know, you really have to kind of tighten up the discipline. I mean, where we were, we weren't putting out OPs around where we stayed during the day. We always came back to the same area. There was no target practice for the men to make sure. Because if you don't fire your weapon for a long time, you know, you lose the instinctive. Because a lot of times you don't have time to aim. really. You look over the sights. But even when you're aiming, you've got to get a little bit of practice and experience, you know. And I really kind of dressed him down. And he stood there and took it, but I could tell by the smile on his face that, yeah. You know, and I didn't know how much of an impression I'd made on him.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel I'd made a lot, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I figured that I, you know, I really should try and get to him and tell him, you know, sooner or later, we're gonna be sent out to the mountains or whatever, sent someplace, and we're going to have a big battle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the men here they've got to be better disciplined. More caution has to be put in, because if you don't be cautious for a long time, you don't run into these big fights, your guard tends to fall down,
mm-hmm.
you know. I tried. But anyway, and that was my fear for them. And
how about personally? Did you think that you would be put out there and then brought back in a few days?
No.
Or you knew
no,
you would stay?
No, wasn't enough time.
Okay.
No, I wasn't. The thing is, I considered very shortly, just the next morning, just integrating myself into this mass of men, getting ready to load on choppers and going out.
Really?
But then I thought, you know, I'd been in the ash out with the cab as a gunner.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought about, well, am I getting in trouble too? And, you know, well, my time is over. I've done my share.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, the hell with it. Now I'm going home. I went around the next morning, you know, sun dawn, and 75% of the guys had hangovers. Everybody was ticked off. I can remember our platoon leader kind of half bent over one of the ropes holding up one of the tents, the large tents, and throwing up
mm-hmm.
with a hangover and the like. And I'm thinking, oh, God, these guys are going into the ash hour in just about 2 to 3 hours. So I went around and I, you know, to all the platoons and to everybody and shook hands and wished them all well and the like.
Mm-hmm.
A guy that I'm very close to right now, who was in, I was in 3rd platoon, he was in 1st platoon initially, and then he was the radio operator for the company commander, Captain Lofton. And he had seen me once before during the incident that I had about a mustache
mm-hmm.
that I've been growing, and he remembers me going around saying goodbye to people. I was kind of known in the company because I was the fool that volunteered for 3 tours.
Right.
So, you know, I don't remember him. The only time I remember him was just vaguely that there was a 3rd person in the bunker when I had to go see the CO about the mustache,
mm-hmm.
and he was asked to leave, and he was an EM. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're real close friends, right? In fact, he was out last Friday on his way to, I stayed with him in Reno
mm-hmm.
in June, and then he was on his way to, Cape Cod, his wife, and he go there, and her part of her family from Albany go there every year,
mm-hmm.
and he stopped by here, so we saw each other again, but we're very close. You know, I went around, said goodbye to everybody, and then I was told that I was being put on detail. It would be 2 days before I left to process out of the country to go back. I believe I went, I flew out of, I processed out of the place I first processed in at, which is called the 90th Replacement Battalion. I've
mm-hmm.
talked about it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It was nicknamed the 90th Repo Depot. I was to go down to Benoit, to there, to the base camp, to the main base camp, 101st, file
mm-hmm.
paperwork, and then go over and leave. I was told, okay, you've got detail, Roy. You're going to be manning one of the guard towers on the perimeter during the day,
mm-hmm.
which is really a get-over kind of job. Okay, so I went out, and I'm up in one of the guard towers during the day, and I watched the helicopters lift off and head out towards the ash show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the last I saw of the company, and I remember, you know, God be with them.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what happened? when they went out?
Yes, a week and a half later on Hill 1041 in the Ash Show. They ran into, oh, God, it was at least a North Vietnamese battalion. It was two of our companies ran into a North Vietnamese battalion, possibly a regiment, and a major battle went on. The platoon leader I had was wounded. Three guys, I believe it was, in the platoon that I knew were killed. The company medic, who I knew, he was a pacifist, but he was a medic, a very highly talented person.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. A black guy. We call him Doc Lefty. Breathwaite, which is spelled kind of weird. It was his real name. He was killed trying to get to a wounded man. They really got kind of heavily mauled before they were able to get a hold of the situation and seize the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anything about it until I got a letter, actually from this Indian I talked about later on,
mm-hmm.
About a month and a half. And he talked about that fight and then something that happened later on where another guy that I knew real well on my squad was killed.
Mm-hmm.
They were in the Ash Shell for a period of time and then went back to maybe 2 months and then went back to Phu Loc. Well, 2nd Battalion went in. And they kind of switched back and forth like this, 1st Battalion and 2nd Battalion, between the coastal area and then the Ash Shell. And ended up going into the Ash Shell again later on. And then I never really had contact with anybody after that until about 4 years ago,
mm-hmm.
when I got on the internet. I read a book. Yeah, on the Battle of Hill 875, the Battle of Dock Hill. I forget which one it was. The overall. And a friend that I had contributed to it. And it gave what town he lived in, and I was able to look up his phone number on the internet. And I had pictures of him and the like, and that was the first person that I met.
Mm-hmm.
This was my first tour. For my third tour, my second tour, it was a while before I met some people that I knew. My third tour, that's where I really met an awful lot of people. It was a very organized group at the time,
mm-hmm.
and they provided an awful lot of emotional support. And they were like a lifesaver.
Mm-hmm.
And I met this guy again that I told you had come up Friday. And we're very, very close friends. And then I met another guy that we're close friends with. I have talked and contacted a couple of other guys that are not active in the group.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of don't want anything to do with anything about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I've met several people like that from all three units. And there are a lot of people that just don't want anything to do with it. So we don't pressure people like that. None of the groups I'm in do.
Mm-hmm.
You let them know that we're there. And anytime they want to talk to an old friend, they're more than welcome. I went down to, a couple days later, they sent me down to Bien Hoa.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was doing processing out and the like, and during the time, I was also pulling guard on the main berm, the perimeter surrounding Bien Hoa. And I remember pulling guard, and there were two new guys just coming in country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were pumping me for all kinds of information and the like.
Mm-hmm. How did they seem to you?
Naive. Incredibly naive. Overly fearful.
Uh-huh.
They seemed a lot more fearful than we were when I first came in country.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, by then the press had really blown things out of proportion, but actually the military position was much better. The really big bloody battles were, well, they weren't over. But only one really took place afterwards, and that was the incursion into Cambodia, which, of course, should have happened earlier,
mm-hmm.
and should have happened again later on, along with But I processed out. I came home.
How did you leave by civilian air?
No, this was the only time I came back by military transport.
Okay. Where did
all
you
the other times coming, going over and coming back were contract civilian airliners.
Okay.
This time I left on a C-131, typical military cargo plane, jet, all the seats face backwards, not very fancy, loud. I'd much rather have been on one of the regular airlines going back.
From where did you fly?
I flew out of Benoit, went to McGuire Air Force Base in Washington State, and then went to Fort Lewis, where I processed out. They gave everybody a pep talk asking them to reenlist or take short.
But, right.
that must have been an interesting job. It was usually met with a lot of derision.
Mm-hmm.
Got one more hard time, bureaucratic hard time from one first lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
But by then I didn't give a damn.
Right.
So I just went along with it and played the little game with them and, you know. But,
How did you feel during the flight back? What was that like for you?
It was a lot of thoughts, you know, what I'd been through, and now it was over, and that phase of my life was gone.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of positive feelings about the future.
Okay.
I was going to go to school and everything. I didn't know what for, but I looked at it all very positively. Ignorant of what was actually in front of me.
Well, there's no way you could know that.
No, at that time, I was aware of the anti-war people, but had never really been verbally, you know, attacked.
Before we leave Vietnam, let me ask you a couple of general questions.
Sure.
That you can kind of reflect upon during your three tours. Do you know at all if you were ever exposed to Agent Orange or any of the other Depoleons?
Oh, yes. Easily.
Yeah? Have you suffered any from them, do you think?
Yes, I have diabetes. It was two universities. I think it was Syracuse and Stanford. I got diagnosed with diabetes. I happened to mention to the doctor 2.5 years ago. Jim, I'm thirsty a lot. And his eyes shot up to one side of that one corner of the screen on the computer, you know, where my blood test and like had come back. And he said, "You have diabetes." And I thought, that's ridiculous. I don't have diabetes. Nobody on either side of my family has ever had diabetes. And I'd always felt that, you know, that's something that other people get. Was I a little overweight at the time? Yeah, I was a little overweight, but... So they set up an appointment with a specialist in diabetes. They took another HbA1c test. And then I saw this doctor, and he explained, well, if your blood sugar is over this certain level after an eight-hour fast, that's it. You've got diabetes, and it's chronic, and that's all there is to it.
Type 2?
Type 2, yes.
Yeah, okay.
So I was kind of stunned. And so they scheduled me to take classes. The VA did, which were excellent classes. But, and right after the classes, I got a letter in the mail from the VA. And in it, the VA explained that these two very long-term studies had been conducted by these two, and again, they were the very high-level universities. I want to say University of Syracuse and Stanford. They showed that the statistically, I had stats for a while, I'm trying to remember. It was so statistically high, the correlations between especially combat troops who'd been in areas with Agent Orange and diabetes type 2, that the VA wouldn't even argue with the findings.
Okay.
Which was incredibly rare. my God, this thing was caused by Agent Orange?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's why. Although later on I did find out that my grandfather on my maternal side had diabetes.
Okay.
But that's all.
Okay.
And so it's called a herbal something diabetes type 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the classes. You get 10% as long as you're not on medication.
Mm-hmm.
And you get 20% disability if you have to take the pills or the insulin. Of course, all the supplies are free.
Mm-hmm.
I lost 30 pounds immediately within 2 months, 2.5 months, somewhere around there. And my blood sugar level fell, boom, right down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still maintaining it without medication of any sort.
Very good.
Do exercise and diet.
Mm-hmm.
And have found out that if you follow a diabetic diet, it's good for you also in about a million other ways.
Mm-hmm.
Although it has risen slightly in the last month or two, there have also been a lot of stressors in my life, and everybody's glucose level. Your glucose level is like a blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
You get upset, your blood pressure will go up. Well, so will your glucose level, I found out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, they've got me on another medication.
Right.
Okay. I don't like taking all these medications, but, you know, and then they put me very intensively into meditation.
Right.
And I'm doing that. I want to get the glucose level down. I want to get off some of these medications.
Mm-hmm.
The antidepressant I'm on is the antidepressant of last resort. It's an MAO inhibitor.
Mm-hmm.
Certain foods I can't take. There are side effects with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the only one that works.
Okay.
The next step would be ECT, which I'm not too thrilled about.
Right.
But
I can imagine.
Yeah, that's the future, maybe. I don't know. Anyway.
Let me ask you a couple other questions about in-country experiences. How much contact did you have with home as far as letters or potentially Mars phone calls, things like that?
Oh, I wrote about once a week.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in Vietnam, you could write a letter and you didn't have to put a stamp on it. You just wrote Vietnam in the upper right-hand corner where the stamp was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were in the infantry, combat troops in the field, you didn't even have to have an envelope and writing paper. You could just rip off the top of a C-ration box, write on one side, you know, a message or whatever, and then put the address and write Vietnam in the corner and send
mm-hmm.
those. And I did that a few times.
Mm-hmm.
I have one letter that my mother gave me that I had written, and God, it sounds so immature. You know, I was
mm-hmm.
19, just turned 19 when I wrote it. I was during the Battle of Dark Toe.
Did you hold back in your letters from telling exactly what was happening to protect those back home, or did you kind of let it all out?
My father and my stepfather were both first sergeants in the Army.
Right.
My real father had been, he was an artilleryman in the Second World War. And, of course, like I told you, I'm named after an uncle, missing in action, declared dead. They all knew what war was. I wasn't hiding anything
right.
there.
Right.
I didn't make an effort to tell them all details,
mm-hmm.
But generally went over, you know, well, you know, things are okay, we're operating in this area or that area, or and then I'd ask questions about home.
Mm-hmm.
And mail is very important.
Right.
Especially incoming mail, it was just so important.
How were you able to keep up with the news from the United States?
Yeah. Even when I was on five-day resupply with the 173rd,
mm-hmm.
We used to get the Stars and Stripes,
mm-hmm.
which is a military newspaper. And I found that the Stars and Stripes was remarkably open about the things that were going on
mm-hmm.
in the States. The racial tensions, the anti-war tensions,
mm-hmm.
Things like that. They told it all, and when I got back, I found what they said was what's happening, and I was really kind of surprised because I would have thought that the military would have downplayed it, mm-hmm. you know, not wanting to demoralize men. But maybe the military also realized that since we had replacements coming in and the like all the time, that word would come by word of mouth, and that maybe the troops would lose confidence in the news that they were getting. So I was quite surprised to find out that they were very accurate and did not hold back.
Mm-hmm.
We also looked, and I believe it was the last page or the next to the last page, where they had the weekly list of those killed or missing in action.
Mm-hmm.
And I always looked down the list to see if there was anybody that I knew, and there was one person that I'd known in high school. He was in the Marines. He was killed. I mm-hmm. saw his name. That was the only one.
Okay.
But there was a short comic section, I believe, and then about military news and, mm-hmm. and the updates on the war itself. And, but it was a very, very good newspaper, and
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm proud and happy to be able to say that they were honest.
Okay.
What
about
we knew what was going on.
Okay. What about the radio? How often did you all listen to the radio?
AFBN. When I was in my first tour, we didn't hear radio very often.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't allowed to have radios out in the field. On my second tour, we listened to radios. Sometimes in between missions of flying around, the pilots would turn on AFBN,
mm-hmm.
And then the crew and all four of us could listen to the music or whatever.
Right.
During my third tour, I listened to... You could have radios as long as you didn't, I mean, you never turned them on when you were on ambush or on patrol or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember, oh, God, it must have been about 7 o'clock in the morning till about 9. There was regular pop music and the like. And,
mm-hmm.
and I believe 9 o'clock, it was either 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, country music came on. Pat Sajak, I can remember him. Quite clearly,
mm-hmm.
a Good Morning Vietnam thing.
You talking about Adrian Kronhauer?
I'm sorry, yeah. Pat Sajak was also one of the announcers there.
Okay, all right.
The movie with Robin Williams,
mm-hmm.
of course, is a movie, and it was nothing at all like the real thing.
Okay.
I remember... I was finishing my first tour, and I was back in on K, processing out,
mm-hmm.
and we were in a barracks, and we're all just laying around the barracks talking, and the music was going,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly on the radio you heard boom, and then you heard all this crash, bang, boom, things falling and the like,
mm-hmm.
and then pfft, it just went off the air.
Right.
And we all accurately surmised, I'll bet the damn North Vietnamese or Viet Cong set off a bomb outside the transmitter. And that's exactly what had happened.
Wow.
We heard it live on the radio, and you kept hearing all this equipment falling over onto the floor,
mm-hmm.
and the like. But I don't remember listening to the radio, except during my second tour when I had more opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
In the afternoon on my third tour, I don't remember. It was only in the morning.
What song?
Music is something
yeah.
that you really miss. And when you hear it after not hearing it for so long, it's
uh-huh.
incredible.
What songs take you back to Vietnam? What do you remember about music?
Oh, all the classical hippie music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Cream, Fifth Dimension, all those people back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jefferson Airplane, the Rolling Stones. When I was coming home from my first tour, this girl that I had been engaged to,
mm-hmm.
Not engaged, this was my girlfriend when I left, and then she kind of dropped me, and I was coming home because she started writing again, and she wanted to see me. Box Tops came out with, what was it? Give me a ticket for an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have time for... Fast Train or
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Right.
And that song always, because all of a sudden I adopted that song as, yeah, I'm going back to
right.
my girl and the like.
Right.
That turned into a fiasco. But still, that song just boom. And there's another one, soul music, High. higher and higher.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that distinctly because the first time I heard it, I was in the hospital after being wounded the second time.
Mm-hmm.
Certain songs like, the classical Going to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And Age of Aquarius.
Right.
That was during my third tour, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so many songs that bring back things. Not that much while I was with the 173rd, because again, until I got back to the rear area I was either in the hospital or to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I just never heard a radio except military radios,
mm-hmm.
The hissing and orders and commands and stuff like that.
Right.
And like I said, when you don't hear music, any kind of music will do almost.
Mm-hmm.
Even Vietnamese. Well, I never could quite understand Vietnamese music, but music is, there's, I've read the theories about how the brain
mm-hmm.
really accepts music due to the beats and the like, and,
mm-hmm.
And it's when you don't have it. And, of course, television, AFVN also had a television station.
Mr. Roy, hold on. I need to interrupt you. We need to stop and change the disc out, okay?
Okay.